Welcome to the latest edition of the Insurers the Best Policy podcast. My name is David Bull, and today I'm joined by Andy Marcel, CEO of Aon's Reinsurance Solutions business. In the first of this two-part interview, we'll discuss the market dynamics that will shape the key 1/1/2020 reinsurance renewal. We'll look at the challenges of conducting negotiations and trading without face-to-face interaction, the experience gap, the impact of COVID-19, reinsurance capital, and the property cat and retro markets. So, Andy, you've talked recently about a much tougher renewal coming up. We're going to get onto market dynamics later, but I just wanted to start by getting your thoughts on conducting negotiations without face-to-face interaction. Does that add to the challenge, and do you find yourself missing Monte Carlo? How are you adapting as a company to operate in this environment and make sure you get the best outcome for your clients?
Great question, David. Let me take the easy one first. Am I missing Monte Carlo? I'm generally not missing being on a plane, spending 4 days preparing for it, spending 4 or 5 days there, and then getting ready for CIEB on the way home. Right. So I think everyone, you know, is taking a deep breath, right, with all the things that are going on in the market and in the global economy, that they don't have to jump on a plane. So not missing Monte Carlo in that sense. It's always useful as a leader of a reinsurance broker that's got a big global footprint to be able to meet in one place a lot of your key executives and meet with your key clients. So that's always valuable. You know, but to your question, yeah, it will be a tougher negotiation. And, you know, to date, you know, it hasn't been a challenge, right, to place business and negotiate with reinsurers, because you have to commend our industry. I think that the degree to which the brokers have been connected with each other, connected with their clients, and connected with their markets has been pretty impressive, I would say, in a moment of, you know, genuine challenge vis-a-vis, you know, what's the impact of their business of the pandemic? You know, what are they going to do to, you know, readjust their portfolios? You know, clients have been responding to the pandemic by generally buying more covers on the global account side, you know, to sort of rebalance and reduce volatility, because in their minds, they already had their cat with the pandemic.
Right.
So there's been a lot of demand on the system, you know, as you've probably seen in you know, our half yearly results. So in many ways, we've sort of, I think, surmounted the challenge. But of course, at 1/1, there's a different intensity, you know, A, from the volume of reinsurance deals that are done, and, you know, B, because all the confluence of factors that have affected the market dynamics, which I know you want to talk about later, again, to sort of coalesce at that time. And so yeah, Negotiations will be tougher. And I think one of the aspects I think that will be more difficult than usual will be how to, you know, bring the major reinsurers and the major clients together while there's this shadow of claim discussions, let's put it like that, in terms of what is recoverable and what is not recoverable, and finding a common ground. And that's we play a role in that, and it's a lot easier to find a common ground sitting face to face with people than it is, you know, via email or via WebEx, or in your case, blue jeans, which I've never heard of until today. So
I'm sure you're wearing blue jeans under the desk, Andy.
I am.
I think it's fair to say you've been around a while, but for many of the younger generation of brokers and underwriters, this is the first time they've operated in a broad hardening marketplace. How, as a firm, do you bridge that experience gap? And is it more difficult because your colleagues are all working from home?
I think it's more challenging because we're working from home, but I think we can overcome that. But you're right. You know, many brokers have not seen a harder market, or, you know, certainly the confluence of events, including pandemic, is new to all of us. But in terms of the traditional hard market in the reinsurance side, where capital has been, you know, massively reduced, and there's a shortage of capacity in a way that, you know, hadn't been seen for some time, say post KRW. We don't have that situation. We have a different situation. But yes, you know, those less experienced brokers, if you want to call them that, you know, will be getting a lot of help in articulating and preparing their clients for how the reinsurers are going to be positioning themselves vis-a-vis the renewal. So I think is there an experience gap? Yes. You know, is it made more difficult by being virtual? Yes. Can we overcome the challenge? Yes. I think that, you know, the industry has adopted technology at an ever-increasing pace, and I think that pace needs to pick up, particularly as it relates to the placement process, the transfer of information. So, you know, Aon, you know, with AB Connect, has, you know, sort of rushed to that in the same way that some of our, you know, peers have in the industry. And so the hope is that the adoption of the technology will increase our ability to bind lines around the world, whether it's Lloyd's or elsewhere, exists within our placement platform. So aside from reducing frictional costs, David, and bringing efficiency to the market, et cetera, it actually frees up people's time to think more strategically than they would have done otherwise when they're, you know, rushing around placing eight different deals at a single moment, right? So you can actually be more organized, you know, it can be more transparent to their senior management so they can get assistance. And preparing and discussing the feedback and the behavior of the marketplace to the clients will be enhanced. So I think the technology reduces that experience gap, but there is still, you know, there is still a gap. But, you know, if you're at a major broking house, you know, you have enough bench strength, enough senior management, and you should have organized your human capital in a way that they can assist our less experienced brokers in articulating that to the customer. Now, that's not going to be even across all our peers, and it's not going to be even within our own firm, but technology does level the playing field in that sense.
Right. And let's talk a bit more about the upcoming renewal in detail and what's really driving market dynamics. This is a tough one. I'm going to ask you to try and sum it up in less than 5 minutes. I know there's a lot of different dynamics at play. And also, what role do you think COVID-19 uncertainty is going to play?
Reinsurers haven't been making very much return on capital. It's a fact. Everyone knows it. Reinsurers in a sort of Aon aggregate through the first half of the year, I think their combines are something in the region of 104. They're not making money again this year. So on top of that, you've got a poor economic environment, low interest rates that were already low. They're lower with less likelihood of them being increased in the medium term. And the long-term projections are still for low interest rates if you look at the 30-year bond market. So, you know, returns for reinsurers are key. That, you know, getting return on capital is key. So those are the market dynamics. And when you overlay that with pandemic, which was, yes, it's a risk that everyone knew existed, right? It's a risk that was partially covered in certain segments of the marketplace, whether it be life or contingency.
Right.
It was a risk that was contemplated in certain property covers, particularly as it related to, you know, contagious disease and government shutdowns around bespoke industries like daycare centers or social services programs and so on and so forth. In many ways, it's an unknown quantifiable loss. That just brings a level of uncertainty. You know, so if you're an investor in reinsurance, you had the floods, which we knew could happen, but they happened, whether it's the Thailand flood or Harvey. You know, you had wildfires, which always knew could happen, but the frequency seems to have fundamentally changed. You have the overhang of climate change and the frequency and severity of typhoons/hurricanes. You know, you have loss creep that is, you know, from the old years. You have social inflation. So you have all these factors operating at all at the same time, David, and your ability to, you know, predict your outcome and manage your portfolio is increasingly challenged, right? So one of the natural responses to that is to increase the rates, right? So to charge more for your products, get an adequate return on your capital so you still have that capital. And that's where the battleground will be. And of course, I think I'm still under my 5 minutes. Each client has an individual circumstance, right? And of course, as brokers, you know, we'll amplify that individual circumstance to ensure that, you know, they get the fairest treatment, right? But our clients also know they live in a global world in terms of reinsurance capital. So our job is to prepare them for that so they can manage, you know, their positions accordingly.
And that links directly with the next question, which is, if the cat reinsurance market is a global pool of capital, should European buyers be prepared to pay higher rates because of losses in other parts of the world?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. It really is a great question because Aon has a unique platform in terms of its commitment to data and analytics. And we look at our global portfolio at a lot of depth all the time, right, to sort of balance that equation. And so when you look at our global cat portfolio, the loss ratio over the last, 4 years is sub 50. Right, that's not, I'm not including, 2020. That's through the end of 19 and development as of 2 months ago on the 19 year. And within that, right, the worst year is, it's not as bad as reported, right? And why is that? It's because we have a really diversified portfolio because we're, we have boots on the ground in most major territories that buy cat, and we have a pretty good share of most marketplaces in that regard. And so when you look at European wind or European cat, the model result, say for the UK, to an outside investor doesn't look tremendously attractive, right? But the actual result, right, is they're all sub 30 loss ratios, right, over time, and some like the UK even better. And so we're modeling this on a 100-year basis, and markets and clients are reacting, on an annual basis, right? So it's hard to say whether the models are right or wrong. If you have that kind of behavior, it sort of questions what your belief in the models and how you would manage your portfolio. But the key is, if you write a balanced portfolio and you're a reinsurer, right, your view of European cat is going to be different than if you're writing like three territories. Right, so can you build that balanced portfolio? And I think you see now, with some of the reinsurers, they seem to be thinking more broadly around portfolio construction. And I think how you construct your portfolio, sure, does everyone want, all the reinsurers naturally want to charge more for their cat products because they're not making any money in a lot of different areas, right?
right.
So, and as I said, there's this unknown, impacts of climate change, et cetera. So those are those, and the capital that's being provided to them, if it's not their own capital, is questioning them as regards what the likely future frequency and severity might be. So sure, I think everyone should expect pressure on rates, but I don't know that it's a European-only issue.
And then you touched on this a little bit, but obviously an argument that's been widely used by reinsurers over the last couple of renewals has been their sort of changed view of risk. So has the view of risk and the cost of capital for reinsurers really changed, or is that an excuse they use as they try to make up for underpricing risk in the past?
So I'll take a simple answer, right? Because of the loss creep on Irma and other wind events, whether it's Faxai, Hagibis, there's a certain amount of loss creep over a period of time that was unforeseen into the extent to which it happened. And therefore, as a provider, of sort of ILS capacity or a sidecar, whatever, to a reinsurer or a fund, your view of your capital commitment simply, is that what you thought was maybe an 18-month commitment is more looking like a 36-month commitment. And if you're, as investing, David, the returns that you want for a longer commitment are higher than for a short-term commitment. That's just the natural flow of, and it also brings into relief other things that those companies could invest in that have a 36-month time horizon. So suddenly, what they're looking for in terms of the cost of capital is different. And then, of course, so genuinely, the cost of capital has gone up, right? In that sense. Simultaneously, when you're looking at the risk of ruin, you have California wildfires, flood, pandemics, and climate change, right? So climate change is wildfires, right? And arguably, or you could say it's broken infrastructure, right? In terms of utility systems. But either way, the frequency of late would lead you to believe that there's increased frequency. It doesn't, but again, we're looking at something over 100, 250 years, right? So nothing may happen for 10 years. But if you're the investor and your board is being asked, questions about how you, is this, does this relate to climate change? How are you reacting to climate change? Should we ask for higher returns as a consequence? The answers are going to be yes, right? So people are looking for a greater return on capital. And so I don't think that it's a myth in that sense. And also, I think you have to, like I said at the beginning, you have to look back and say, we haven't made any money as a reinsurer. And therefore, obviously, I need a higher return than I was targeting. Because otherwise, you have to say that my pricing was so bad, right? Or I have unexpected events. So yes, they need to adjust their pricing to a new normal. And that's the pressure that is going to be occurring.
Well, that was a good answer. And you mentioned this, you talked a little bit about the kind of capital side of the equation earlier. And I think your own half-year data shows that reinsurer capital pretty much recovered in Q2, along with the investment markets after turmoil in Q1. And, you know, as we've been reporting, there is newly raised capital coming into the sector as well, either through startups or scale-ups. But I think the overall consensus is that this is not a traditional hard or hardening market driven by capital destruction. So in that context, what impact, if any, will new capital have at 1-1?
Look, I represent insurance company clients that buy reinsurance. You know, so we welcome, and we always do, new capital to the market because we want the market to be the most competitive and the best price for our clients as it can possibly be. That's our job. So I hope that the new capital that's come in, right, will assist in that. However, I think it's worth pointing out that some of the capital that's come in is actually with existing players.
Right.
And so maybe in part it's in response to their lack of desire, inability or lack of success or uncertainty around producing third party capital. Right. So they can produce capital for their own balance sheets and put that to work. They can maintain their market shares and or take advantage of a market that's improving. And I think you'll see that some of the companies who are fantastic firms that have raised that capital, they're not seeking to drive down prices. They're seeking to position themselves with the clients they want to position themselves with in a more robust way. So that will be interesting. There hasn't been yet a new cat writer appearing on the lens and that's going to be significant that you can point to and say that would be big enough to dampen the rate rises that our clients are under pressure to respond to. But that's just a cat story. You know, there's a casualty story, which, you know, we can go into now or we can talk about later.
Before moving into casualty, which is definitely on the agenda here as well, just sort of finally on the subject of capital raising, but, and again, you talked about investor appetite a bit already, but I mean, how is that going to impact on a kind of collateralized side of the marketplace and what, you know, what kind of impact will that have in terms of the kind of key retro renewal at 1-1?
Well, I wish I had my crystal ball. But I would tell you that the retro market is sort of it's sort of banded together as a sort of one thing, whereas really it's sort of, there's excess of loss retro, there's cat on DNF, there's ILWs, there's cat bonds, there's quota shares and sidecars, right? Those are the vehicles that are providing the reinsurers with their capital protection and sources of capital. Yeah. And so, you know, I think that when you think of straight up XOL retro, it's roughly sort of half and half between rated and non-rated. Now, when you think about cat and DNF, it's like 80% rated paper and 21%, you know, non-rated. ILWs is heavily non-rated, about 85%. Obviously, cat bonds are all non-rated, but not, you know, in a real sense. You know, quota share is the reverse of that, right? And sidecars are pretty much all non-rated, right, by their nature. And so I think when you have to look at the sort of non-rated capacity, right, and which is the collateralized reinsurance vehicles, and let's take out the ILWs and the cat bonds, because there's a pretty robust ILW market, and I think you'll see more activity in that, depending on how the retro market responds.
Yeah.
The cat bond market, as it thinks about supporting reinsurers, we expect in the tail. Now, tail for reinsurers is not the same as tail for insurers. It's more sort of 1 in 25, you know, return period is not, you know, 1 in 250. There is capacity there in the cat bond market, right? And the cat bond market is increasing in relevance, across traditional cat and retro, particularly in their respective tails. And the ILW market is the ILW market. So that when you start narrowing that down, you get into the sort of XOL retro, which is then split between occurrence and ag. And I would say within that marketplace, which is, let's call it $20 billion of limit, that there's probably $4 billion of trapped capital. There hasn't been a ton of new raises. And when you think about the ag retro, there's probably five markets, right? That are willing to put out any kind of meaningful. So as you start narrowing down the retro world, there are opportunities. So if you're a buyer of these products, you have less flexibility if you're, say, in Lloyd's, because you need to buy the cover to meet the plans and the mitigation metrics that the society operates under. If you're a large rated reinsurance company, that's global in nature, you're not as under the same amount of pressure. You could reduce your writings, but interestingly, no one is talking about reducing their writings. They're actually all talking the opposite about increasing position. So, which is why, yes, there'll be a more difficult renewal, but we wonder how much more difficult it will truly be. So that they could just take the risk on their balance sheet, David. They could cut their limits, or more likely, they'll avail themselves of, the ILW and cat bond market in a more meaningful way while working with us and our peers, to form longer lasting relationships, partnerships with potential quota share counterparties. So I think that's what you're going to see. You're going to see a bit of a shift in this sort of ball of wax, as people call the retro market, and it's going to become much more, segmented, and the treat and the way that people utilize, the capital that's in that space will be different.
Just very briefly before we move on to casualty, but do you sort of see the retro product needing to evolve? I mean, I'm talking particularly about those areas that obviously have been affected by trapped collateral issues over the last couple of years. Do you see a need to evolve there? And if so, how do you think it will evolve?
So, David, the trapped capital issue, I think when it's there's a large hurricane, there's a lot of rain, wind-driven water, and a lot of rainfall and a lot of flooding, and you get loss creep. That is a frustration, right? To, collateralized vehicles, and they don't like their capital being trapped because they want to utilize it again. But at least in that circumstance, you can understand, conceptually what's happening, and you can explain it to, your investors, and you can adjust accordingly. Now, as frustrating as that is, because the investors now say it's a longer duration commitment, therefore I want a higher return, which we already discussed. But that's okay. Well, it's not okay, but it's manageable. When you have trapped capital from, losses which there's uncertainty around the size because of coverage issues. And if you're a client, you don't want to release capital in the event that your predicted outcome is going to be different. And this is an ongoing, set of events, right? And we're learning more about the impact of the economy and so on and so forth, and how jurisdictions globally will, regulators deal with insurers and their willingness to pay, right? Let's call it that. On covered or uncovered claims, right? So there's a, and what people's view of that is shifts. The regulator's view, like the UK, has shifted, right? So, and trapping capital, which I think is a, is you can see why the reinsurers would want to do that, right? And if you're the fund, you can see why they don't want to do that. So I think we'll work it out, and there'll be an answer, and there's, people will eventually be able to raise more money, and some client relationships will become stressed and some will be okay. But in the end, if you're a buyer, you're probably going to be more drawn in the medium term to rated paper. But I think rated paper, all things being equal, will have an advantage over non-rated paper for that reason. I don't know if that's an evolution, right, or a revolution. It's pretty much as I'm sort of stating the obvious. And then I think in terms of what's evolving, so we used to joke, you and I, reinsurance is really complicated. It's either proportional or non-proportional, right? But I think the com the com so I don't know that the product evolves in that sense, right? But I think what will emerge is everybody seeking greater clarity on what they are actually covering. So is this genuinely an all perils follow the fortunes policy? And how many of them do you have and what am I protecting? Or is this a name perils and what are we not covering? So I think the focus and a lot of pressure on the brokers to make sure that the wordings and the coverage is reflected increasingly accurately. So when you're in that, what capital are you trapping and why, the answer will be simpler.
Well, thanks, Andy, and thanks to everyone for listening. In the next episode, which will air later this week, we talk to Andy about casualty reinsurance, buying strategies in a tough market, demand and structural changes, and of course, the pending Willis transaction.